Welcome to the Medical Imaging for All podcast, brought to you by Clarius Mobile Health. This show is dedicated to exploring the trends and technologies shaping the future of medical imaging. Here's your host, Ohad Arazi, CEO of Clarius Mobile Health. Now, let's jump right into today's episode.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to another episode of our podcast, Medical Imaging for All. Today, I'm joined by Tracy Byers, the CEO of Enterprise Imaging at Optum Insight, part of the United Healthcare Group, which is the largest insurance company in the world. Tracy has had a stellar career across some of the biggest brands in healthcare and is here to chat with us a bit about her journey and about imaging at large. So before we dive into the episode, Tracy, could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Ohad. I really appreciate you having me. So I've spent the better part of almost 30 years now in the medical healthcare IT space. I started my career at Philips, actually in finance. So little known fact, I had a finance degree before I got my MBA, but I started at Hewlett Packard's medical business and it got acquired by Philips and spent a significant amount of time both on the acute monitoring side as well as the imaging business. And then almost 25 years into my career, I was asked to join IBM Watson Health's new startup in healthcare. And I went over really to learn a lot about AI and ML and how it could apply to healthcare IT. And it was an incredible experience. IBM is such a great company. But as so many people know, it was really difficult for big tech to get into healthcare and really understand the deep clinical domain that's required. And frankly, the difficulty of applying AI to some of the most complex health challenges. But shortly after that, I chose to join Change Healthcare and now Optum and leading the enterprise imaging business. And I've been there 4 years. It's been an amazing experience. I absolutely love my job and my team and especially love my customers. So it's been a great long career run so far.
Amazing. Well, there's so much to unpack there. And maybe what really strikes me is that, you know, you've worked for some of the biggest companies in the world, literally, and yet your leadership style is so personal. And you're right out of the gate, you're talking about how much you love your customers and your job and your whole face, your body is telling us that, right? And I know this from your leadership style, having worked with you and having many friends and colleagues that work with you, is your ability to connect. How have you managed to balance that, right? Where we tend to have this perception that a big company is going to be somewhat impersonal. It's just a job, right? And yet you are so personal in your approach. How have you done that, Tracy?
Honestly, I think it has to do with really good role models. So I had the opportunity to work on a startup business at Hewlett Packard, which was the AED or automatic external defibrillator business. And this was a really novel concept which required creating a category. So sudden cardiac arrest was not something that was well understood or well known. And how AEDs were deployed across airplanes and schools like we see. And I think being able to work on a project like that inside sort of the umbrella of a really big company like Hewlett Packard and then later Philips was probably, you know, the place that gave me some of my best learning experiences. It was led by two people who remain incredible mentors for me. One was Steve Ruskowski, who is the outgoing CEO for Quest Diagnostics. And Steve was an early mentor of mine for 30 years now. And also Deborah DeSanzo, who's now the president of Best Buy Health. And both of them really gave me great role model examples of caring deeply about and being passionate about the healthcare problem you're trying to solve and pulling together some of the best and brightest people to solve those problems and to really treat people with respect and dignity all through the process and to keep people first, you know, in the context of driving your business. And those are some of the rules or some of the things I learned from them just as role models.
I can connect to that as well. I think that in healthcare, many people that choose to work in this industry, which is a super tough one, it sometimes feels like we're pushing a wet noodle up a hill every day, but they do so because they have a connection to a bigger why, like they have a calling. And I think you're so right that maybe the key to unlocking that talent is finding ways to connect with them at that level, to find that personal why that each of us have and connect it to the corporate why that we're serving as a company. And that's how we get that interlock and maybe that real discretional effort. And maybe that is what makes it so fun and special for these individuals to work in healthcare, which is why it lends itself to a different type maybe of leadership.
I think when you know that what you're working on, you know, for us, an enterprise imaging solution, knowing that a patient could be in the middle of a cath procedure and whether your system is up and running or not, could be life or death. I think it really makes people's sort of mission and commitment to their role much, much bigger than if they don't understand how they connect to the mission.
But it sounds like that wasn't what drew you from the get-go. You started on the finance side, and then you moved into these really clinical products like AEDs and bedside monitoring and medical imaging and AI. What was that transition? Like, where did you start at HP and on finance? Like, you were doing P&Ls, and then how did you make the jump into the clinical side?
Well, like so many of us, I think we're rooted in our very early years of life. And so my dad was a metal machinist by hobby, actually. And so we had a metal machine shop in our basement that rivaled most professional machinists. And I knew how to run a lathe and a drill press and even a bridge port, probably by the age of, 10 or 12. And I came to have a real passion for understanding the way things work. And so I think, you know, going into finance, I was a product of graduating in the late 80s, and everybody who I went to college with was all thinking about Wall Street. And I knew I didn't necessarily want to do Wall Street, but finance was sort of a close cousin. But I think it was really one of the best ways to learn a business, to understand what the levers are to run a business, and also to realize that growth is so important, that when you find a solution and you can really execute in driving growth, that is probably one of the best ways to run a business, is to manage aggressive growth. So it gave me great foundational, but I think that passion for knowing how things work and wanting them to be better, it was something that was deeply rooted in my childhood. And so it led me, I think that plus my extrovert personality, which I know is there, I think those things kind of combined to taking me into product roles and then into commercial roles and then ultimately into general management roles. So for me, it felt very fluid to go from finance to marketing, you know, to sales and then ultimately into general management.
So three, I think, quick takeaways from our early conversation for our listeners. It sounds like one is find mentors, great mentors that can really pull you in. And maybe the key takeaway from there is to create that connection with the team and with a purpose that's driving the people around you, the reason they join the company, the reason they work in the sector that you're serving. And then it sounds like the transition for you from finance into the product and into general management was really driven by this kind of passion for growth orientation, but also maybe the initial roots of learning how things work. And actually, there's no better way to understand a business than through a P&L and actually understanding the ins and outs. So that's very interesting perspective. I love extroverted CFOs. So actually, I've always looked for kind of connecting with my CFOs that are not just about the numbers, but actually about the business. And of course, you've made that transition long ago, but it's also something actually that I've sought out as I've worked with finance professionals.
I will tell you that I find, though, that my optimism can be a little dangerous. I always look for a CFO who can temper my optimism so that we end up probably in the right answer between the two of us. So I know exactly what you mean.
I appreciate that. You know, I'm just going through kind of working with our middle management that just did their DISC profiles, which is kind of like this behavioral model. And I talked to them about how important it is to not hire clones of yourself and actually to have a well-balanced team. In my ELT, I have 10 members, and I think we have 2 to 3 in each of the 4 DISC quadrants. And it's so true. Like you, I'm like a hardcore DI or ID, like very extroverted. And like, oh, I see like a glass half full. And for me, it's like 90% full when I see it. It is true to balance that. I get that balance on the operations and on the R&D side of kind of like the art of my imagination versus the art of actually what's possible, and try to meet in the middle. And on the one hand, inspire, but on the other hand, temper and find ways to communicate with them that they're not reeling actually, but that they can lend their introspection and their grounded kind of sobriety into what we do. But I know what you mean about that balance.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would have to say, at least in this role, one of my most rewarding relationships is with our head of engineering. One, because for me, it really fulfills a passion of really understanding how things work. You know, we're taking a platform that really was designed in an industry that was created almost 20 years ago, primarily on-premise, and re-architecting it for the new innovation of cloud native on any one of the cloud platforms. We happen to use Google. And, you know, it's been a great relationship because for me, pairing, and not to oversimplify, but, you know, engineering tends to be more introverted, more analytical. And I think the combination of my leadership style with the technical acumen that our engineering leader brings really leads to, I think, a great organization, you know, a great strategy, sort of taking his strengths, my strengths, combining them together. And I really think that we have a better engineering team, you know, because of it. So I'm a big believer, like you, in the power of combined strengths rather than, God forbid, a group of replicates of all the same type. That would be really frightening.
Very true. No, the power of the yin and the yang working together. I want to come back to something that I said in my opening about just your background, Tracy, and thriving in these really, really large organizations. And it's actually a topic that I think about a lot because I lead a high growth company. I'm interviewing a lot. We're hiring a lot. And many of the people that are interested in working at Clarius are coming from big corporate and talking to me about the fact that, oh, I've had this corporate career and I really want to make a jump into a startup or a scale up. And I'm always kind of quick to say, just time out before you do that. Just make sure you know what you want and what you're walking into. And actually to share, you know, when I left big corporate, I was 11 years at McKesson and Change Healthcare and then at TELUS, so about 15 years in big corporate jobs, which I never thought of myself as a big corporate guy, but the numbers don't lie. And then when I went into a startup at Zebra Medical, I initially hired a lot of people from big corporate and actually not many of them were fits because of that misalignment. And so how have you done that? How have you succeeded in these big corporations? And how do you think maybe, you mentioned kind of that when you went to IBM, it was kind of a startup within a big company and maybe the AED business at Philips and HP was similar. How do you think about that tension between a big company, small company, and what it gives to each of us as individuals?
Yeah, I think, you know, like you said, I am a product of largely big company culture. But I think the thing that I've always sought out within the confines of those big companies is both leaders and businesses that require a high degree of personal accountability and autonomy, as, you know, from a leadership style. And some of my best successes have been when either I was given a really complex problem, frankly, a business nobody else wants to run. My best example is they couldn't find anybody to run the MRI business at Philips because they were a distant third in the market. And they thought, you know, let her go cut her teeth on this. And, you know, and I think I had a great boss at the time who really gave me a lot of autonomy. It was sort of like, look, you can't make any worse, so go for it. And the other thing, like I said, is accountability. I do think that you have to find people, even in big companies, that have very clear, frankly, desire to have a high degree of accountability in their role. Because without that, I think it is really difficult to drive aggressive growth. So I think those are the attributes that I look for when I'm looking for a role or what my next challenge is. I share the same thinking that you mentioned, which is whenever I'm looking to infuse new talent, and frankly, we're in the spot right now, which is we've designed a really compelling architecture with our cloud native solution. And we have about 10% of our data under management moved to the cloud. So we're in the early stages of scaling. And when I look to scale the organization, I want a mix of people who might have been from startups, who took an idea from a very early stage and really have experience scaling, because so often big company people don't have, you know, direct experience in big scale. And so often I think that that potentially could be a weak point for big company experience. And I've looked to kind of combine those two skill sets, not be heavily weighted in any one or the other by each team. And so probably the best example is 2 years ago, we made an acquisition of Nucleus Health based down in San Diego. And Nucleus was a small company, less than 50 people in the team, primarily product and development folks. And we've had great success in integrating and infusing their startup mentality with our, you know, existing teams. It's done exactly what we wanted, which is to really infuse sort of a lack of tolerance of slow decision making. And we've had 98% retention. And I have to say, you know, on some level, we're doing a good job of combining both, you know, the startup mentality with sort of what I'll say the heavy process experience that comes with a big company.
Yeah, maybe it's an extension of the yin and yang concept we talked about of routing out the team, of actually having that balance of the impatience, that bias for action that comes from people that really thrive in building early scale, going from 20 to 100, coupled with people that know to take it from 100 to 1,000, which is a different skill set. And that's process, that's building kind of bulletproof organizations. And so that's an interesting balance. I certainly feel that topic of pace is the biggest challenge from big corporate to a small company. And again, like my experience has been when people that are coming from a larger company talk about that and they want to change because they do want to move faster. Maybe they're frustrated by the fact that it's taken a long time to execute on a vision they had and they had a dominant market position. Maybe they're worried about losing it because we're moving too fast. We're getting, you know, eaten up by these fast moving fish. But when they come into the startup, I think they almost feel a little lost because like everything happens so quickly and you have to move on it and you don't always have the full team to do it. You're like very much a player coach, which maybe in a big corporate, you had a team of 20 people doing that. Now you as the leader are kind of rolling up your sleeves and getting deep into it. So I think that that is one area where I have found challenges. And maybe your point is to just find that balance within the team and have each other create enough healthy tension to make that work well.
Yeah, there's two thoughts that come to mind. One is, you know, we've recently, you know, run into challenges where you have sort of the startup mentality kind of wanting to move fast. And then you have it kind of colliding with, you know, the mentality of, hey, we have a process, we have to be very careful. And a lot of times it's around InfoSec and some of the security concerns that we all face in healthcare IT, protecting patient, you know, healthcare data and information so rigorously. And, you know, I have found, you know, that it actually relates back to some of the cultural things we're talking about, which is if you really set the tone for a very collaborative culture, many times that collaboration can be sort of what greases the skids of resolving an issue between the, I want to move fast, I want to make decisions quickly. And not to say that fast necessarily equals sloppy, but sometimes it can be significantly more risky. And I have seen sort of the power of collaboration sort of help, like I said, grease those relationships. And for me, I really try to set the tone about how important it is, you know, to listen to each other. You know, email is not one of my favorite modes of communicating. I think it so often leads to misunderstanding, but I certainly am experiencing even at United, you know, their appetite for risk starts to get lower and lower the bigger the company gets, you know, primarily because the brand is so much more valuable. And finding the proper amount of risk for a business to take, the bigger the company is or the parent company is pretty tricky, particularly in healthcare informatics.
I can see that. I mean, clearly, Tracy, you're very skilled at change management. You shared with us the integration process of Nucleus, right? 50 people into your prior organization, which was like, I think like 1,200 or so, right? And now integrating a 1,200 person organization into like a 400,000 person organization at United. So you're undergoing constant change. And that I think is something very true of big companies generally. You tend to think of them as like this one kind of really solid mass entity. But the reality is big companies stay big, stay successful by constant reinvention and acquisition and integration and change. So I'm really excited to see where this next phase takes your enterprise imaging group inside the broader Optum and United Healthcare, but certainly a lot more change on the go. And it sounds like you're going to keep smiling and thriving through that.
Yes, we certainly will. Innovation is a big part of what we've got to stay. You know, we've been having so many discussions about generative AI and how that applies to our solutions and our business. And I know it's a hot topic and a big core of your business. So it's the topics to consider in innovating the landscape seems to getting broader and broader.
It does. No, and that's a great segue maybe to talking a bit about technology. And so two things really come to mind from our conversation so far is maybe talking about this transition to the cloud and then a little bit on imaging AI, which is an area that both you and I have worked on. But let's start with cloud, because I feel that really your company, again, kind of going back to this dichotomy of big corporate versus small company, you are really at the forefront of taking a stake to say cloud will play a role in the lives of these big enterprises that we're selling into. And maybe for those of our listeners that don't know, really the sweet spot of your medical imaging group was selling into the big, big corporate IDNs, huge success in deploying massive scale of medical imaging systems. And yet you were the first one to say, we will take a big stake in moving from on-prem to the cloud. Talk to me about that decision and ultimately how you decided to architect that journey.
Yeah, sure. It started before I arrived, so I can't take credit for the seed of the idea. But it was really an observation of what was happening with our customers. So in the United States specifically, radiology is a diagnostic tool, or imaging is a diagnostic tool that's probably, if not the largest diagnostic tool that physicians use for all kinds of disease states. And when you think about the fact that 50% of all U.S. radiologists are over the age of 55, you realize that there is a capacity or throughput problem that they're facing today. You hear a lot about physician burnout and the focus on productivity, delivering healthcare for lower costs on every level that you can imagine. And I think that the genesis of bringing the solution to the cloud was about what could we help deliver in terms of innovation to really help workflow, productivity, both for radiologists as a customer, you know, healthcare IT as part of a hospital system. And it really comes down to a couple of key things. One is imaging data is a huge set of data, particularly as CT modalities get larger and larger from a file size standpoint, you know, 64 slice CT, 128 slice CT, those files are massive. And as that data and the requirement for storage was getting bigger and bigger, hospitals needed help in thinking through how are they going to scale this over time? And then also how are they going to apply, you know, innovative ways of analyzing that data to better healthcare. So from my perspective, it's really in helping drive down cost of ownership, cost of maintaining, but also unlocking the data of medical imaging. I think there tends to be a misunderstanding about how readily medical imaging is utilized, and it really is not well utilized as a data asset. In terms of most hospitals have it locked up in servers, you know, in the four walls of their hospital. And if we were able to put it in a cloud where it was much more easily accessible and anonymized, the power of that data could be used to train AI algorithms to, you know, help do medical research, improve care paths. It really has a huge opportunity, and the cloud is just simply an enabler to do some of those things that would help with productivity and helping imaging overall as an industry.
I mean, I can see the rationale on why this makes sense, but yet back to your point around data security and the fact that hospitals were historically kind of married to this CapEx one-time perpetual software license model, and also used, I think, to the fact that they needed to control the asset physically, like they like to have their IT hands around the data physically in their servers. We talked about change management earlier organizationally. How about change management with the aspect of cloud migration? How do you convince these big corporate customers to say, hey, we will do a better job than you and we will thrive in this OpEx model, which you've never used and you have to kind of retool yourself to adapting to that? That sounds like a very big lift.
Yeah, I would say actually it's really rooted in five things that were happening in the industry that you know, I think we just recognized. One was, we know that the site of care was moving outside the four walls of the hospital, that radiologists needed to be able to access images anywhere, anytime, frankly, on any device. We also started to realize the value of the data and the need for large health systems to be able to look at that imaging data and do analytics. The third is cybersecurity. The number of hospitals that have experienced a data breach is rising, and the cost of those data breaches were really huge. And what we originally, the fourth and the fifth are the resource shortage or physician burnout that I mentioned, and also COVID and the pandemic need to be able to not go into the hospital to be able to do your job as a radiologist. But all of those things, I think, initially when we would talk to CIOs and chiefs of radiology and cardiology, there was a resistance that they could do a better job of protecting their data and, you know, PHI or personal health information themselves. But what they quickly realized, largely because of the ransomware attacks that were happening on so many health systems across the globe and COVID, those two things really propelled the industry to think about this differently. And I would say that now, probably more than 50% of our largest customers are interested in moving to the cloud, beginning the journey to the cloud, whether it's through their archive or some component of their enterprise imaging system. And now they're ready to move much quicker than they were even 3 or 4 years ago before COVID. And I think it's largely due to some of those, you know, most recent experiences that have happened in the market.
And no doubt companies like yourselves taking a strong position in that and shining a light on how it gets done motivates others to start to follow suit. You touch on an aspect of the cloud, which is interesting, which is increasing its access to researchers and to the AI community to develop models. And the topic of imaging AI is one that across our podcast, we've come on to many times. And what really strikes me that, especially in your space in radiology and cardiology, where by and large, AI is being applied after the image acquisition, it's used as an interpretation aid to streamline workflow or to get better interpretation outcomes, is that the industry is not consolidated yet. It's highly fragmented, which often feels, I think, to the radiologist, like an Uber Eats takeout menu, right? It's like, you know, you're having like one dish from one vendor and another from the other, right? And so like, I could get my intracranial hemorrhage model from one company, but my pulmonary embolisms from another. And then if there's one thing I've learned about radiology in my years in that space is that it's all about workflow and efficiency. So if now the workflow is really disjointed because there's multiple vendors in the mix, how is that ever going to work? Like, is that why maybe AI hasn't yet had the full realization of the value of its promise? Or maybe it has. I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's just my observation now looking from the outside in.
Yeah. So a couple of thoughts. One is, I do think that reimbursement has a huge part to play in whether we're successful in really the adoption of AI. I have no doubt that AI will become a critical component of, you know, radiologists' workflow. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And I know you oftentimes, I heard an interesting quote by someone from Google recently, who said, radiologists won't be replaced by AI. And you often hear that fear sometimes articulated. But what will happen is the radiologist using AI will be replacing the radiologist who doesn't. And so I do think that it is a tool to aid in supporting them for their peak, you know, efficiency and productivity. I do think that reimbursement's probably one of the biggest barriers. I also think that the access of large data sets, and I think that the work that we're doing in terms of taking our install base to the cloud and also working with partners to really be able to curate imaging data so that we can serve it up for algorithm training is super important and maybe one of the barriers, frankly, you know, to some of the slower development. But you made the point, which I think is really sort of at the net of it all, which is until we can embed AI so that it doesn't actually create additional clicks or additional steps in workflow, that, you know, we won't really cross through sort of the barrier of widespread adoption. And I think that is the place that's frankly the trickiest. We've really focused on only developing and investing in algorithms that really improve the workflow and not actually looking at the image recognition part of the AI field, because it takes so much data to train those algorithms. I see the industry as being really early in its maturity, both in understanding how algorithms work, understanding how they're trained, because a lot of times you run into skepticism, and you, I think, know more about this even than I do, but skepticism's about whether the algorithm has been trained properly and whether its answers are always right and will continue to be right. And I think that fear, until people really deeply understand how the algorithm was trained, are going to be hard-pressed to really embrace it.
Excellent. Tracy, we've covered so much ground today, from your background as a finance professional through HP, Philips, IBM, Change, Optum, and United Now. We've talked about leadership, the yin and the yang, and cloud and AI. So a lot to take in from this conversation. If our listeners want to learn a bit more about you, where should they go? Where can they find out more about Tracy Byers?
Absolutely. Happy to hear from anyone. I'm on LinkedIn, Tracy, T-R-A-C-Y, Byers, B-Y-E-R-S. And I'm based up in New Hampshire, a New England girl. So would love to hear from anybody who might want to talk a little bit more about imaging.
And for all of our listeners, Tracy is absolutely the most approachable person I know. So I do encourage you to seek her out. And Tracy, really, that was so much fun. I learned a lot. And thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Yes, this was awesome. I really enjoyed it. And I can't wait to go back and listen to the other episodes. So thanks.
Right on. Well, to all of our listeners, as always, we appreciate the time together. And be sure to catch us on the next episode of our podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Medical Imaging for All podcast, brought to you by Clarius. If you enjoyed today's show, please do us a favor and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. For the latest episodes, please visit www.clarius.com or search Medical Imaging for All on your podcast platform of choice. Thanks again, and we'll catch you on the next episode.